Thank you, David. And perhaps before introducing our two panellists, I'll just skip over a slide in my introduction about the surprises that came out of the survey, and I'm going to be questioning our panel about that as well. But there are a number of things that did surprise us, and we're not supposed to be surprised if we're a forecasting firm, but we did get surprised. One of the questions you might notice on the survey, when you've got a chance to go through it later on, was religion. And religion rated dead last on the 100 by the people who filled in the questionnaire, which is, I think, in itself very, very interesting, because I'm old enough to remember when I first started work and you filled in those forms in those days, one of the questions was, what's your religion? And I can remember asking the person that had that on the form when I first started work as a graduate from university, why is that there and did it matter? And the person hastily said, no, it doesn't matter, it's just left over from times distant past. And I thought, oh yeah. But as it turns out, religion wasn't an issue. But there was a time when religion was on an application form, a bit like age and all sorts of things which are now outlawed today. The second thing that surprised me too was that given that we were hot on the subject of a republic and in fact had a referendum on it as recently as November 1999, it rated second last. So that's no longer important as an issue, some 8 years later. Unionism, and God knows I'm old enough to remember the fights we had back in the 70s and 80s, that actually ranked 97th. So how issues come and go. And yet contractualism, which is the big fight over this year's election, or it seems to be at this stage, in other words, do we go back to collective bargaining or go into contracts, that's rated much, much higher than unionism, up around 83rd. Taxation, which we're forever complaining about, actually came in 38th, so clearly the business world doesn't see taxation as holding them back too much either. And as I say, the big surprise was water coming in at number one, because if we'd had the survey 10 years ago, maybe even 5 years ago, it wouldn't have even rated in the top 10 maybe, but today it did. Enough of that. I'm going to make a very brief introduction to two people who need very little. Firstly, the Honourable Nick Greiner, who I had the great pleasure of meeting, and he may not remember this, way back, I think about 1987, when, in fact, he was, the key attendee at what we used to call the Pinnacle Awards in those days. It was a black tie event held at the Regent in Sydney here to award the top entrepreneurs and the top performing companies of the year. And Nick was, in fact, the guest of honour for one of those particular occasions. I then had the great pleasure of hearing Nick, of all places, in Barrel. Nick was one of those premiers that believed in rolling up your sleeves and talking to his executives down the line, and he instituted a whole series of, executive development programs, if I can put it that, and many, many times I could hear the helicopter whirring in to land in the grounds of this Barrel thing. Nick would step off the plane without a single note in his hand and hold the entire audience spellbound for about an hour without a single note, making it quite clear what he expected of them as Premier. That was very, very impressive. Nick no longer is in politics. I'm not sure whether he misses it or not, but he certainly is a busy professional director. And I'm not going to go through all of his directorships, but he's on heaps and heaps of them, and it makes me tired to think of how many he's on. But he says he has time, though, these days to take a holiday, and that's good news. So, Nick, you're very warmly welcomed. Thank you very much for being here. Now, Catherine, I've already thanked you for being on our expert panel. A double thank you for being here today, too. Now, Catherine also, she's scary, actually. I mean, when you think that she's been the managing director of Cochlear, one of Australia's great companies, and she was with Nucleus, she's been chairman of the CSRO, she's currently a director of Telstra and God knows how many other companies. You're a very impressive lady, Catherine. Thanks for being here today. That red becomes you now that I've embarrassed you. Thank you. Now, without any further ado, I'm only going to get the ball rolling because I'm a great believer in letting the attendees get their questions in as well. So I'm going to kick start with a few questions and then throw our dear panellists open, including David, incidentally, too, who's up there, to all of you to see what you'd like to explore with them. But I'm going to begin, if I may, with you, Catherine, that having been on the panel, what were perhaps the key surprises to you out of this survey?
I think, for me, and that's probably reflecting a personal bias, but I suppose I was surprised that the whole question of innovation and intellectual property and industry mix, which were two of the issues on the list of 100, that we basically we didn't get to them, we didn't even discuss them. And to me, that was it was a big surprise in the context of knowledge economy and where we think our future economic well-being is going to come from.
Yeah, I think I'd agree with you totally on that too, as it turns out, Catherine. Nick, could I ask you the same question, if I may?
Yeah, well, I was surprised that technology was, which is my word for, I think, the collection of issues that Catherine just raised, I think technology is very far down, almost invisible, and that surprises me. I was also surprised that security, which at the end of the day is a very fundamental human craving, seemed to be lower, and partly there's sort of classification issues, I suspect, but I do think security slash terrorism slash whatever was lower than I intuitively thought it might be. My third one, where I was a bit surprised, was demographics. Again, it's a bit of a classification issue, but I'm a big believer that demographics drive most things. They certainly drive many industries. They drive a lot of government response and non-response. And my sense, I wasn't there for the discussion, was that the demographics didn't really rate as highly as I might have thought it would.
Okay. And that is interesting too, because a lot of things, I mean, I think you were saying over lunch too, Nick, that, you know, the question of ageing, for example, which is not an easy thing to solve, is one of those that you may well have raised. Perhaps whilst I'm with you, Nick, I might ask too, the question of how much governments, be they state or federal, can address issues like we're trying to uncover in these surveys. How much power does government have to do that, and what gets it moving?
Well, I must say I was pleased to see federalism was where it was in the expert panel list, because I think the truth is governments cannot by themselves solve very many of the issues at all. On the other hand, they're fundamental in terms of creating an environment within which the community, which obviously includes government and business and so on, is able to solve or at least attempt to solve the problems. So I think in many ways, if you look at the list, the things that have in some ways dropped down are things where performance has improved. I think the community thinks economic management, even though I think the economy was predictably number two or something, but a lot of the subsets of that were fairly far down. I think that the capacity of the institutions to manage, if Glenn Stephen from the Reserve Bank was here, he would say that the various institutions can manage the economy better, and the track record in terms of surviving various external and internal shocks suggests that performance is better. So when performance is better, people look at these things and think, well, it's an important issue, but it might be further down the list because those who are charged with direct responsibility seem to be better at doing it. So I guess my answer, Phil, is that governments can't do it by themselves. They do, however, where there's political will, they do tend to set the agenda. They can set the environment that makes things possible or less possible. And you know, you might expect me to say this, and it's not a particularly partisan political comment. I think political will, in terms of acknowledging that quote that the David read out from someone saying change is inevitable, I think if you look around Australia at the moment, there is actually sort of reform fatigue, especially amongst the state governments, and they're really running with a view that change is not inevitable, and where it's quite popular to, in fact, slow it down. So I think the government's role is crucial at every level, not in terms of the government fixing the problem, but in terms of the government creating the circumstances within which it might be fixed.
Okay. Which is interesting, Nick, because one of our panellists was Jeff Gallop, also a retired Premier from Western Australia, and during this expert panel he made the comment that if there's three things businesses should remember in getting governments to do anything, it's politics, politics, politics. I think that's what they said. In other words, you've got to make it easier for government to do things by putting in a very hefty lobbying campaign, which means that government then can almost do a Pontius Pilate and say, well, it's clear what we've got to do, you know. And perhaps there's been a period when business was somewhat quiet on issues through most of the 90s, I thought. I think they're gaining a little bit of impetus again now. But I thought that was an interesting feedback too.
Not wanting to hog the conversation, Phil, but it seems to me that one of the reasons why state governments in particular, they do happen to come from one side of the political fence, are of the view that politics is the overwhelming thing, is that when you've got 16 or 17 years, which is unprecedented, of economic prosperity, then there isn't really a political necessity to do lots of things. So if you have a non-entrepreneurial approach to government, it is quite comfortable to sit back, and you do need people to create political pressure to create an environment where you can say, well, you know, sorry, I had to do it. I think the fact that we haven't had a recession in the better part of two decades is one of the reasons why the pace of reform and the willingness to look at some of the more difficult issues, that willingness is a lot less than it was in earlier years, where you tended to have a recession every 7 or 10 years.
Yes. Well, if I can add to that, Nick, it's interesting. I mean, if you look at the history of unemployment in Australia, it might be of interest to know that over the last 219 years, that full employment is the norm rather than the exception. That out of each of the centuries we've been through, 60% of the years have had full employment, in other words, less than 5%. The good news is we've just finished 30 years of unemployment, and it's therefore unlikely we're going to get unemployment again this side of the next 30 years. Now, that's a double-edged sword from what Nick's saying, because if the economy's that good, there may be some complacency built in. On the other hand, the good news is if the economy's going that way, you've got more money to fix some of the issues anyway, so it may be a double-edged sword in that sense. If I can throw one last panel before throwing it open to the floor today, it might be to say, to what extent do both of you as panellists, and David, you might like to answer it as well, would you expect, say, the issues to change in importance from year to year? And what would that mean if they changed slowly or fast, picking, the, say, the top 10? How much do you expect them to change each year we do this survey?
I'll have a go at that one, Phil. I think they will, actually, because I think it's very hard for us to, as much as we try to look out over the long term, not to be governed by some of the more temporal issues. Now, I think there'll probably be about half of those ones which will stay on the list, but perhaps it'll come to some of the ones in the way in which I think some of the expert panels saw water, for example, being an example of something where we do know what the solution is. People are familiar with what needs to happen there, but there's some issues around which prevent us from actually getting it done, and they are sort of some political issues and some structural issues and the like. Those things you would expect over the longer term would not be on the agenda, but I think there will still be that clutch of issues which remain, which are sort of, you know, which are going to come onto the agenda and off the agenda depending upon what's happening. And just to follow up on one comment that that Nick said about security, that was the one that really did surprise me, that it wasn't rated higher. And you wonder even whether now, having had the experience in recent days of what's happened in London and Glasgow, whether that might be sort of more prominent and preeminent in people's minds, and as they start to see the wider implications of that, whether they might actually have that pushed further up the list. Similarly, even if you think about instability in the region, with Papua New Guinea and Fiji and the Pacific Islands and East Timor, as our experience unfolds there, you wonder whether that will cause those issues to sort of come onto the agenda more if there's some incidents which we experience.
Catherine, how much would you expect them to change?
Actually, not a great deal. I think they'll morph. I agree with David. I think the water issue is not so much the issue of water, but the issue of why we can't solve the problem when we apparently know what the solutions are. I think the health one will change. I mean, we've got health, government health policies, but actually the bigger issue is community health and the personal responsibility for health, because that's actually the root cause. If you can address that, then the government policy becomes a derivative. I'm not sure about the war and terrorism and the security issue. I just wonder whether we've somehow absorbed that into something we're going to have to deal with for this generation and the next, as we dealt with issues in the 70s and 80s. Whether we've just come to accept that that's going to be a permanent situation. I'd perhaps also just add the comment on the federalism and the priorities for government. I think in the panel discussion we really took the view that these issues are so big and actually so long-term that the whole institutional framework in Australia really has to evolve faster than it has done, which I think is partly what Nick was implying. We have to find a way of getting things done faster because time is of the essence on many of these big issues. That's why they're big. And hence the priorities, the government priorities issue, which came in at number 10 from the panel, was saying we really think it's important for government to establish priorities and work towards those priorities over the longer term rather than through the sort of political opportunism of the electoral cycle.
Thank you, Catherine. Nick?
Look, I wouldn't add much to that other than to say I do think that the recency, currency, call it what you like, has to have some impact, and to go against common sense to suggest that that recency or currency or publicity doesn't have a have an impact. The other thing I'd say is that I think the issues might change the way they're presented. I mean, I am in the camp that says water's not an issue at all, and not because God sent rain recently. There is no doubt that that technology's around to create as much water as we like. The economics are understood, essentially an absence of political will in terms of fixing it. On the other hand, if you recast it as a sustainability issue, and how do we make our continent, if you like, sustainable, and then you've got climate change and a whole range of issues, and you've even got people issues, the number of people in the workplace as opposed to those of us getting older like me who might retire. I mean, I think if you take sustainability as an issue, and it would take bits and pieces out of various of those, I suspect that will remain there, and that does have elements of water and other things in it.
Thank you, Nick. I mean, a couple of things. One is that the expert panel actually pulled communications, particularly telecommunications, back up into the top 10, which pleased me, I must admit, too, because broadband's pretty close to my heart since we're an online database company. And but again, I think it's like water. It's not a big problem. I mean, there's something like over $50 billion worth of money already tied up in the telecommunication companies, being Telstra and Telecom and Vodafone and Optus and so forth. So even if you spend another $10 billion, which would probably put broadband through every damn home, probably at the highest speed almost available today, it's nothing. I mean, what's $10 billion? It's chicken feed. It's a fraction of a percent, really, of the annual federal spending, and let alone what the private sector could put into it. But anyway, it was good to see that. But that's, again, a soluble one to me, like water, and probably even quicker. And one would hope that would drop off the list because we're back up to the top three world's best practice instead of number 17 today. The other thing I might add on priorities is that something I should say that we were limited with this survey is that, if anything, it had a business bias. In other words, in asking 300 people, not of all whom are in business from the trustees, a lot of them are from academia and other areas as well, but we have toyed with the idea in future surveys of seeing if we couldn't get a societal ranking of issues as distinct from a business ranking of issues, as distinct from maybe even a government ranking of issues, although one would think that government would flow out of the first two. But that's for another time in another survey in the future. But it does bring a slight bias being business-oriented, for which we don't apologise, we simply mention it. But, for example, the expert panel raised the whole question of Indigenous affairs very, very highly. Now, from a business point of view, with 2% of the population being Indigenous Aboriginals, and with it not affecting their business greatly, they didn't rate it highly at all. In fact, it wasn't even in the top 100. But if you did it on a societal basis, it would probably well and truly be there, which is not to say that business shouldn't be interested in it at all, but interesting. Now, I think enough for me on that. I think it might be time to throw it open. The only thing I'd like to do is perhaps pick on Peter Roberts, and I haven't given him a single bit of warning about this, but Peter is the editor-in-chief of BRW, and Peter has taken over the BRW, I think from July last year, is that right, to put a new look on it? And I know innovation was very high on your agenda as well, but is there anything out of a survey like this that helps you fashion, you know, BRW content, you know, for a year or two in advance, if that's not asking too leading a question, Peter?
Well, I think from the panel discussion, it evolved from just the basic availability of water into this more complex issue of why can't we solve the water problem when we have so many institutional structures and so much knowledge about the water issue. What is it that's stopping us from pulling that all together and getting something done? So it was a subset of the overall ecology issue, but then it really started to focus on why are we so impotent when it comes to solving the issue when we actually know the answers.
One of the things that always intrigues me about water, and sorry, Nick, you'll add to this, but I mean, it's an extraordinary population that came here in 1788 and decided to settle where there was no water, because, as you may know, 60% of Australia's water is in the top one-third of Australia. We just deemed it was too damn hot and humid to live there, so we didn't. And even today, there's only 3% of our population living north of the 20th parallel, which is where almost the bulk of our water is. So either we'll move north to where the water is or shift it south or do something, but there are many other solutions. Nick, did you want to add to that?
Oh, only to say, Peter, that I think the reason these issues are important is they're ultimately standard of living issues, and business as well as the community at large are interested in their standard of living. I do think that Australia, perhaps Phil's just said this in a different way, has been a bit of a lucky country, to borrow an old book's title, and I think we're now coming to a realisation, well, things don't just naturally happen. Water doesn't always just naturally come. Natural resources seem to be there at the right time and the right place. But the future in terms of energy and how we do it in a way that maintains the quality of our natural environment, I think is eventually a standard of living issue. So most of these things come back to how do we maintain or improve the standard of living of Australians as a whole, and I think a subset of that is the how do we improve the standard of living of those who are somewhat left behind by the economic progress of the last 20 years.
Thank you, Nick. Well, this is again open to the floor, and just the usual CETA guidelines is that in going to a microphone, which we'd prefer you to do if you wouldn't mind, although I can see Peter was fairly well heard, if you want to ask a question, the nearest microphone would help. And could you announce your own name and your company in so doing? So are there any questions so far? Away we go. Questions or observations, if you like. We'll take both.
Chris Drummer from MBF.
Thank you,
I was
Chris.
Heartened that health was raised, I think, from number 11 up to number 7 once the experts were involved. I know we have a very good private public health system in Australia, which I think might tend us to sway towards an element of complacency. But the latest intergenerational report was released, and it showed that the increase in healthcare costs over the next 40 years would grow by 4 to 5% of GDP. That increase in healthcare costs is greater than the entire defence and education current budgets as a percentage of GDP currently. And I'm just wondering to what extent that really is the sleeper for our economy over the next 40 years rather than some of the other sustainability issues.
Well, I think that's in a sense part of or related to, Peter, the demographics issue. I mean, the reason that healthcare is going to be a larger and larger share of GDP is that there's going to be more and more old people, and old people get sick more, and of course technology keeps them. So it's being driven essentially by demographics and to a degree by technology. And I think they're the two things that I felt were two of the three things that were underscored. So I do think you're right that how we deal with the ageing population, how we deal with the sort of intergenerational equity issues, how we deal with the fact that you've got an inverted population structure with more and more people over 60 or over 70 is one of the fundamental issues. And, I mean, that obviously goes to sort of where MBF is and where a whole lot of other issues are. It also goes to a point that Catherine made in passing about sort of community health or prevention, because just sitting around saying, well, it's a big issue, there's going to be more and more old people and they get sick more and that costs a lot of money and who and how are you going to pay for it, is one approach. The other approach is to say we obviously need to redirect some resources, quite significant resources, to prevention, to community health, to people being responsible for their own health in a greater degree than they are at the moment. I do think that tied up in there, but I would categorise it as being fundamentally a problem of population movement from which the various health issues, which are very difficult to solve, incidentally. I think they flow from the changing nature of the population.
Catherine.
Phil, yes. I suppose that's, again, just to reinforce, I was surprised that the community health issue wasn't further up the list, because it actually goes to the whole viability of the next generation workforce when you look at the diabetes issue, for example, and the obesity. But then again, that's why I was surprised why innovation wasn't there, because if you look at the intergenerational report and the issues described, you can find innovative solutions to many of those cost drivers. And so as much as sort of the medical technologies drive the healthcare costs up, you can also have technologies which bring the cost down, and that's linked into, dare I say, broadband capability, because you can have a much more efficient delivery of a healthcare system if you can use broadband to access capability in one spot when the actual individual or patient is in another spot. So I was very pleased to see communications there, but very surprised at the lack of the innovation, big issue.
Yeah, which is interesting. I mean, quick thing on the health. I think we're currently spending 10% of our GDP on health, compared to 15% it's now up to in the US. I think it's climbed from 13 to 14 to now 15. Mind you, I've always thought the definition of an ageing society, we've got to be very careful about the definition of old. I was getting a bit sensitive there, Nick. And somebody once said that old is always 20 years older than you are right now. So I think 87 is getting a bit beyond it, but not my age. And no,
Phil, could I just make a point on innovation? I do think that's where you can see, if you look around Australia, dare I say it, I mean, the Queensland and Victorian governments have actually done a pretty reasonable job of focusing attention, some extent providing resources, just creating an environment. And if you look at the performance of those two states in terms of, you know, Peter Beattie calls it a smart state, and I don't know what Brax calls it, but whatever they call it, they've actually been effective both by talking about it and by setting up some structures and some funding, seed funding mechanisms. I think it has actually improved. I do think overall Australia tends not to be encouraging of innovation to the extent other countries both in Europe and North America are. And it's part of our, you know, we're not heavily into risk, and we're not heavily into, in some ways, not heavily into entrepreneurship. And I think it is, I mean, Peter's magazine has made a clear effort to sort of promote innovation and small companies. I do think that's one of the issues as a community and as governments that that we need to think about more, because sort of accepting that we have a brain drain and it goes overseas, and, you know, accepting that we don't have much high-risk venture capital, we now have lots of private equity, which is a different sort of risk profile. I think that governments do have a role in saying that innovation is important. And you'd have to say over 20 years, they by and large paid more lip service to it. And I think I was guilty of that, incidentally. Paid more lip service to it than actually done much about it.
Can I add to that, if I may, and then I'll ask you, David, please. But you may or may not be aware that the Melbourne University has just done a study of how much money is spent on R&D and how much does the country get out of it in terms of standard of living and productivity. And we independently, my own company, have done the same study. One of the extraordinary things to come out is that the level of spending on R&D has no impact at all on standard of living, nor does it have any impact on productivity. In fact, in the days before R&D was even measured, up to, say, in the industrial age, up to the mid-60s, when there was no measurement of R&D whatsoever, the productivity was higher and the GDP per capita growth was higher. In other words, if we're going to be an innovative country, it's sad to say the level of R&D spending has got absolutely nothing to do with it. Or if it has, it's very little in any measurable. In other words, there must be something else. There must be something else that's innovative that's not being counted, you know, like trademarks, patents and all the rest of it. all I'm saying is innovation pays, but I'm not sure that we're measuring it right. Would you like to add to that, Catherine?
Look, I think that's right. Can I just say, I think R&D is really important because it builds the knowledge stocks of the country. R&D and innovation are two very different things, and I think that's been one of the mistakes in Australia. Innovation policy has been research-centric, and the view has been if we fund research, that's enough.
Yes.
And, in fact, research is one of the elements which needs support. But I'll come back to my concern that industry mix wasn't on this list, because the absorptive capacity of industry to take up the outcome of your research is a very important environmental factor. And so that could be one of the reasons that you're not seeing the nexus between the research and productivity, because we don't have a sufficiently deep industry capacity to pick up the ideas, and they flow in many cases overseas. So I'd hate us to draw the conclusion that R&D and innovation are not linked. There is an important middleman in there, and it's called business. It's called industry.
Okay.
Because it's industry that innovates.
I've just washed my mouth out. Thanks, Catherine.
Good.
Okay.
David.
I just had one comment on a similar theme, which is on innovation. And we've just done actually some work as CEDA on the innovation area. And really what comes out of that study, it's from this Competing from Australia project. There's one paper in there by Thomas Barlow where he says, look, it really is the way in which you look at innovation and how you define innovation. We need to broaden our definition. Rather than being stuck just on technological innovation, we need to look at some of the things that we do in terms of inventing new systems, inventing new processes, and putting disparate pieces together in different ways. And that's actually the point of his paper, is to show that that's an area where Australia has actually excelled at.
Okay, fair enough. Open the floor again. Any other questions or observations from... Yes, sir.
Bob Cooper, Institutional Developments. As a long-standing member of trustee of CEDA, I'm delighted to find CEDA taking this initiative. It's the sort of initiative that I've come to expect from CEDA. It's clearly a very important subject, and I was interested to see the approach that you took on seeking community responses on a set of priorities. My personal view is that I believe that the big initial first priority nationally is in fact demographics. What in fact is going to be the shape, the nature, and the geographical spread of our population in the next 25 to 50 years? Because that's the beginning of demand. And then with demand identified, you can then begin to say, well, then this is how we can satisfy demand. So that's my contribution. I'd like to congratulate you on this, and I'm going to look forward to getting my BMW.
And BRW.
It's equipment anyway. Thank you, Philip.
Thank you very much, Bob.
To this.
Thank you. Right, any more? Sir.
Hills. I'd like to know whether there were any difference in, say, states or territories in some of the answers of this. My surprise was transport, and, for example, was transport a bigger issue in New South Wales?
I can't give you an answer on that. I don't know, unless you do, David.
No, we didn't actually segment it by state. We will next time, John.
Yes. I think just to make a point that I made earlier, we really hope to make this a bigger, better, deeper and more thorough, you know, survey each year, and so it truly does give us the sort of priorities and the perspective, if you like, that I think we need, because really, as a business world, let alone a consumer world, where we're not careful, we do drown in information, as they talk about information overload. Well, it's certainly here, and if anything, we're trying to sift through that information overload. I mean, as Hugh Mackay, a long-standing colleague, says, if you know, it doesn't take much to worry the average person. The trick is to try and, in a survey like this, put some emphasis on the things that might be there, but they're not top issues. So if we do nothing else over the years but to let the really important issues float to the top, I hope that's of use to business people and the community at large by saying, yes, look, we know there are issues there. I mean, some people were surprised that terrorism, you know, didn't rate very highly either. And yet in England, you know, where they've got more fears than we've got, people go about their daily lives, and terrorism probably doesn't even rate in the top 10 anymore, whereas it might have done way, way back. And even though they can still get bombed up, they say, well, yeah, okay, that's life. Now, we haven't, you know, got that luxury just yet, but it didn't rate on our list. But we hope, as I say, to tell us what we need to worry about, or at least work on, if not worry about. So any more questions or observations? We've got time for at least another five. Thank you, sir.
Newts. I'm interested, when looking at the differences between the list that was put together by the seat of trustees and the list put together by the panel, but in particular, labour skills was a big mover. And hiding under that heading, there are some very big topics. Education, also the demographics issue, I suspect, globalisation, various other things. And I'd be interested in a comment from this panel, but also particularly from people who were involved, if there are other people here who were involved in the panel as well, on why it was labour skills got promoted so much. I wonder if it's one of those areas which is sort of thin end of the wedge of the demographics, that we're starting to notice the effect of the demographics in terms of reduced numbers of graduates, ageing of the workforce, and that, in fact, four of the top 10 have got an element of demographics in them, although Nick's quite right, demographics per se hasn't come up into the top 10, but there are elements of it there, and I'd just be interested in a comment on that question.
Well, ignoring me, we have three of the panellists who are on that expert panel here, that's Elaine Henry and also Neil Warren and, of course, Catherine. So, Catherine, do you want to start on that as to why that panel did lift it up a notch or two?
Well, I think because it was a proxy, as you say, partly for the demographics, but all of the educational issues. And, yes, I mean, there was discussion around the graduate skills, and there was a subtext there relating to sort of health and well-being as well when it came into the workforce flexibility and working hours and so on. So it was the panel had a really difficult time distilling the top 10, and we went through quite a number of different models to work out how we could filter so many issues, even down from 20 to 10. So there's a sort of a degree of editorial prerogative here that just said, well, we'll find the best fit that covers the landscape that we think is important, and labour skills was one that covered quite a bit of landscape.
Would you like to add to that at all, either Neil or Elaine? You don't have to, but Neil?
I suppose one of the issues that the panel had was this tension between a problem and the process to resolution of problem. Mm. That was evident quite often, because if you look at some of the issues that were raised to the top of the pile and with the panel, these are, in a sense, focusing on potential resolution of other problems. That's why federalism gets to the top, into the top 10, because really it's seen as a catalyst for addressing a range of other issues. So when you look at this, you have to be a little bit mindful of what was in the head of the panels versus in the surveys, because they were coming at it, as Catherine said, from some tensions about exactly what we were doing and what we were focusing on. So the thing that I find quite important in this whole exercise is to think also not just of the problem, which are all around us, but to the next step, which is kind of the process to resolution of, and what are the catalysts for the resolution of those problems. So that was creeping into the panellists' mindset, and that in a way begins to explain what you're seeing here with the structure that we took.
Thank you, Neil. I mean, one of the points thank you very much, Elaine. All right, okay. I think Catherine's point about knowing the mix of industries is also underpinning a bit of this, because if you don't predict where your mix is going, you've got a little bit of trouble also sorting out what labour skills you're going to need. And we've had a number of quite embarrassing periods over the last 30 or 40 years by getting that wrong, one of which was the hospitality and tourism industry, where I think at one stage we had about 150 people going through William Anglis and the one up here in Sydney when we were needing something like 4,000, I think, that year. Our ability to pick skills in advance, probably still... And when you look at the change that's happening to manufacturing, which is now down to 10% of our economy, whereas it used to be 30, now that China's starting to supply us a lot of stuff, you realise, look, industries aren't forever, and what's the next role, and what's the... That. You combine that with a seller's market for labour like we've moved into now with full employment, and I'm glad the panel did pick up labour skills and kick it up a bit. Thank you, Elaine.
I just want to go back and reiterate one of the big issues for us was the definitional issue. What were we talking about when we were asked about education? Yes, it was a big issue, but it came into four different categories, whether you were talking about labour skills or productivity, et cetera, et cetera. And so it depended on the lens the particular person was putting on that issue and their own interpretation. I think we went through and said, the interconnectedness of all these issues needs to be distilled a little bit in the next survey. That was one of the things. But just an observation that, that I had, coming back to Nick's issue about prevention in the health arena, the whole issue of what are we doing from early childhood over the life course, which comes back to education, of course, was vitally important. And it wasn't Elaine Henry raising this issue. It was the panel, the economists in particular. If you remember, Phil, they were talking about, well, CEDA's really not just about economic development,
true,
it's about social development.
Correct.
And the issue of Indigenous rather shocked me, I have to say, that when we were having the discussion, you might think Elaine Henry would bring it up, but I think everyone around the table did. And it was an issue for business, not because it might only affect 2% of the population, but the impression, we were talking about a global economy, a global world, the impression that people overseas have of Australia, because we're not dealing with the issue, is very, very top of the mind of the panellists. You know, it's an issue. We can't just sit here. And this was before the emergency, so I think people really do believe it is a priority for Australia business as well as for Australian society.
Thank you, Elaine. I might throw in a question.
Phil, sorry, could I... The gentleman from Freehills asked a Dorothy Dix, which I didn't get to answer, and it goes against my religion. he asked about transport. The point I really wanted to make was not to have a shot at the excellent transport management in Sydney, but to say that these things do all interconnect. I mean, an issue that's not really there at all is the future of our cities. And, of course, 20-25% of our 21 million people live within 50 k's of where we're sitting. And the geography, the topography is such that makes it harder, and the historical decisions make it harder still. The question of transport ties into sort of location of jobs, the nature of work, how many people sit at home with their Telstra-provided communications and work from there, or will work from there in the future. And so I think the nature of our cities, and transport's obviously fundamental in many ways to that, is an issue that didn't get identified in those terms, even though, again, it comes into many of the subsets. And I suspect that going forward, the future of the cities, and particularly Sydney, which is both the largest and the most difficult, I'd be surprised if that didn't become more and more of an issue, because it's by now very difficult to solve, and you rather doubt that there's going to be a very creative effort to do so.
Thank you very much, Nick. Look, we're almost at that magic hour again. I'm just going to... it's almost like asking a butcher if he's meat stuff, but... Can I have a show of hands who thinks this is worthwhile doing year by year and getting better and deeper at it? Is it going to be helpful to you and to the business world? No? Okay, we won't do it again then. Right, okay. But we intend to anyway, but thanks very much for the support. Look, we have reached that magic hour, and a good chairman is one who does finish on time to let people go back to work. But I'm going to call now on Greg Martin to give a vote of thanks to our panellists today. Greg is the Chief Executive Officer and Managing Director of the Sydney Ports Corporation. If you think that's small, it's got over $1 billion worth of assets. I think it drops $150 million to the bottom line of that each year. Greg came from having panel-beat and sorted out the Brisbane ports, I think, before that, if I've got that right, Greg. We've left that in first-class condition. So, Greg, thanks very much for doing this. Over to you to thank our panellists.